If you're looking to improve your life, there's no shortage of self-help books that you can turn to. The Secret, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, The 7 Habits of Highly Productive Public Radio Producers. That one's very popular around our office. But Sven Brinkman thinks we need less self-help and more anti-self-help. Brinkman is the author of an anti-self-help book called Stand Firm. It was an overnight sensation in his homeland of Denmark. Steve Paulson sat down with Brinkman to find out more.
Sven, the subtitle of your book, Stand Firm, is Resisting the Self-Improvement Craze. So let me start by asking, what's wrong with self-improvement?
Nothing is wrong with self-improvement as such. If we know why we're improving ourselves, if we know why it's valuable to improve ourselves in a certain direction, then it's all right, it's fine. You know, all children should be educated, they should learn, they should develop themselves and become mature adults, autonomous decision makers, and all that. That's all fine. The problem is that self-development, self-optimization has become a duty, it has become a burden throughout our lives, which means that we are never good enough. We should always improve, always perform better. And I think this is really weighing us down. It's creating a lot of problems for us, you know, related to stress and anxiety and depression and other mental health problems. So my book is about the need for us to learn to stand firm and sometimes resist this demand to constantly change and be flexible and movable and adaptable. We need to put down roots as well as moving around on our feet.
So I'm curious about whether you think this trend, the self-improvement craze, as you call it, whether that is getting worse. Do you think there's more obsession about that now? And because, I mean, you talk about how our culture seems to be accelerating. And in fact, there's this phrase that we now live in this era of liquid modernity.
Yeah, liquid modernity is a term created by the sociologist Zygmunt Bauman. And he said, we live in liquid modern times, which means that everything is moving. Nothing seems to be permanent any longer. And every one of us, all individuals, should make themselves flexible, movable, liquid in order to catch up. But it's doomed to fail in a way. We can never catch up. We can never be good enough. So I think we need to find other ways of talking about life, about existence, about what a human being is. Yes, certainly we have feet. We should be able to learn and be creative and develop ourselves, but we also have roots. We should also be allowed to put down roots, think about how our lives are embedded, how our identities are embedded within larger communities and traditions and social practices. We have been taught to think about those things as limiting our freedom. But I think all that is a precondition of our freedom. Freedom is not about cutting loose and, you know, uprooting yourself. It's about realizing the roots that you have, because that is ultimately what defines you as a human being.
So is it fair to say that you have written an anti-self-help book?
Yeah, I haven't really made up my mind yet whether it's a self-help book or an anti-self-help book, but I think it's fair to interpret it as an anti-self-help book. It's articulated as a self-help book, complete with 7 steps.
It's your own way of sort of tweaking that whole self-help industry.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I don't promise the reader any happiness or wealth or something like that. I promise the reader a more realistic view of him or herself and the world. I promise the reader an antidote to this self-improvement craze.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I love about your book is your anti-self-help book is that you have written your own 7-step guide.
Yeah.
And I want to go through some of these steps. Step number 1, cut out the navel gazing. What do you mean by that?
We put so much emphasis on everything that is subjective. How do I feel? What are my needs? We think that we should make decisions based on gut feelings, on what it feels like inside. And of course, all my steps are formulated in a polemical way to mirror the way that a normal self-help book articulates its points. Everything should be taken with a grain of salt. But I really do think that there are important decisions in our lives that we cannot make just on the basis of how something feels.
And yet a lot of people would say that, you know, those first feelings, those gut feelings, that, you know, is sort of before it's all clouded by, you know, you're trying to rationalizing stuff off, and that's the truest response you have. You're saying we should be skeptical about that.
Yeah. I mean, our immediate response is often important, but very often we should suppress it and do something else. Because we have duties to others. If you have kids, I have three children, you know, when they were smaller, they were really annoying, as all babies are. You know, they would wake me up in the middle of the night. I would sometimes have to change their diapers, etc. And my immediate response was, ugh, I don't want to do that. But of course, I had to do it because I was their father. It was my duty to do something that my gut feeling told me not to do. Of course, this is a trivial example, but I hope you can see what I mean. We have so many obligations in our lives that we can only fulfill and understand if we are aware that we sometimes need to listen to other things besides our gut feeling or immediate impulse.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, there was a different philosophical train, the Stoics. Didn't they talk about something called a negative visualization? I mean, this is sort of a technique that that you could employ.
Yeah, exactly.
What was that?
I introduced this technique in the book to counter the idea of positive visualization, which we often hear about. You know, you have to imagine the good things that you would like to achieve, and then just imagining them will make it easier for you to achieve them. That's positive visualization. We have scores of books about that and courses you can attend. Negative visualization is in a way the opposite. It's imagining that the good things that you already have are temporary. It's imagining that the persons you love, the possessions you have, the achievements you've made will disappear. That's negative visualization. Why on earth would you imagine that?
Right, yes.
Well, the Stoics would reply, because it's going to happen, because you are going to lose everyone that you love, just as they are going to lose you, because life is short, it is temporary, and all the successes that we chase aren't really that important on a larger scale of things. So in order to prepare yourself for reality, for mortality, that was the Stoic advice here, you should do negative visualization. And it works. Like my example before with my parenting skills or lack thereof, when my baby, you know, would have, I don't know, some problem with the stomach or something, he wouldn't sleep, he would just scream all the time. Would positive visualization help? Would it help for me to, you know, look at him and say, I wish he wouldn't scream. Oh, I wish he wouldn't scream. That's positive visualization. It doesn't help. What helps is negative visualization. This is directly from the Stoics. It's quite dramatic. But they would say, in this situation, imagine that the screaming baby would be a silent baby, a dead baby. This is very difficult to do,
yeah.
But that works. You know, wow, suddenly a screaming baby turns out to be...
You're thankful for your screaming baby.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's creating a kind of gratitude for what we have, because we know that we're doomed to lose it ultimately.
Hmm. Now, I'm curious about how these principles, how you have applied them in your own life. I mean, because obviously you've been thinking about all of these ideas for years. I assume you try to live according to some of these things that we've been talking about. And I'm wondering what's changed for you.
Yeah, initially I wrote the book for myself or to myself. I told my wife, actually, I need to be able to say no more. I have to learn to say no. I always, you know, try to be polite. I say yes to too many things. I need to write a book about that. And so I did. And yes, you are right. I try to apply these principles whenever they are relevant. And they aren't relevant all the time, but some of the time they are. I do try not to do this navel gazing all the time. I try sometimes to ignore my inner feelings. Leonard Cohen wrote this wonderful line in That Don't Make It Junk. He says, I know that I'm forgiven, but I don't know how I know. I don't trust my inner feelings. Inner feelings come and go. But we put so much emphasis on our inner feelings. We should trust them, listen to them, live by them. And I would say they're nice to have when they're nice, but don't trust them. Cohen is right. He was right. They come and go. we should do our duty. We should be decent human beings instead of being, you know, self-absorbed, narcissistic, authentic selves all the time. I'm no better than anyone else. I'm just as narcissistic as everyone else is in our culture these days. But I do try to fight and resist that tendency within me.
I know that I'm forgiven, but I don't know how I know. I don't trust my inner feelings. Inner feelings come and go.
Sven Brinkmann is the author of Stand Firm, Resisting the Self-Improvement Craze. He talked with Steve Paulson.
That don't make it jump.